Thank you, Madam Speaker. After listening to the member for Denry South for the better part of an hour and a half, I was certainly left with the impression, Madam Speaker, that there's no way that I would wish or could conceivably emulate him. And therefore, I would, for the time being, not take into consideration the several darts and arrows that he decided to dispatch this side of the House. I have other pressing matters to deal with. And Madam Speaker, I want first of all to draw the attention of the Honorable House to a statement made by the Honorable Prime Minister. And Minister of Finance, in January this year, I want to refer to what is normally regarded as the traditional New Year's address by the Prime Minister, and in this instance also the Minister of Finance. In that address, the Prime Minister spoke to the people of St. Lucia about the state of the St. Lucian economy. After drawing attention to the fact that there was a decline in tourism, he went on to say the following, and I want to quote him. Notwithstanding, there was an overall increase in economic growth attributed principally to the ongoing expansion in the construction sector and the associated spillover effects transmitted to other sectors. Significant ongoing investments in the tourism sector and the intensification of works on other government projects dominated construction activity during the period. And then the crucial words. The recovery in the agricultural sector also contributed to the increase in economic activity. Banana output rebounded by 35% to 20,416 tons, resulting in a 41% increase in export earnings. Output for non-traditional crops also expanded by 22.4%, with 58% growth in exports. The total value of output for the manufacturing sector also increased by 0.9%, with a varied performance amongst the main manufacturing products. Madam Speaker, the decisive words. Notwithstanding, there was an overall increase in economic growth. That, Madam Speaker, was in January this year. 3 months later, to be exact, the Prime Minister comes to this House and announces to the people of St. Lucia that growth, GDP growth, has decelerated to 0.5%. In a matter of 3 months, we have moved from economic growth to a deceleration of growth to 0.5%. Understandably, Madam Speaker, there has been shock and surprise at this news. Why was it that the people of St. Lucia were not informed in the course of the year that the economy was undergoing major contraction? No matter how kind I wish to be to the Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance, it is patently clear that this country was misled and never told the truth about the state of its economy. I, for one, Madam Speaker, do not believe that the economy slumped to 0.5 growth. As a matter of fact, I am prepared to argue that the economy fell into negative growth. But it was too hard, too difficult to come to this house and say that we are in negative growth. But time has to tell. Because you see, Madam Speaker, there's always a disclaimer in the Social and Economic Review. The figures in the Social and Economic Review tell the story. Tourism down by 7.4% in 2007. Banana exports to the UK down by 10.8%. Marginal improvement in manufacturing, but real growth decelerated to 1.7%. Construction down, contrary to what the members of the report put, then we start to leave, down by 10%. And most significant of all, liquidity in the banking system is at an all-time low. According to the Social and Economic Report, there is now a liquidity crunch in the banking system as the demand for credit exceeded the level of deposits. Do not for one moment come and say to me that there was an increase in revenue, so the economy performed well. Do not come and say to me that there's a reduction in the deficits. Because the improvement in the overall deficit is fictitious. It is unreal. The only reason why you had an improvement in the deficit had to do simply with the fact that there was non-implementation of major capital projects in this country. The premise of the capital budget vanished, disappeared. And so, automatically, your deficit had to narrow. What should concern each and every one of us around this table and this country at large is this simple question. What went wrong? Why is it that an economy that grew in 2006 at 5.5, 5.2, 4.9, these are the figures being bandied around, suddenly just decelerated in a matter of months to 0.5. Why are we in this sorry predicament today? What went wrong with the economy that the economy could slide from a GDP growth rate of 5.02% in 2006, according to the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank, to a growth rate of 0.5 in 2007. According to the Minister of Finance, the decline is explained this way. This is what he says at page 6. The deteriorating external environment continued to impact on the pace of activity in the domestic economy. High and rising world oil and commodity prices, particularly food prices, presented some economic challenges and uncertainty. And in addition, the passage of Hurricane Dean in August impacted adversely on the performance of the banana industry. The consequence, Madam Speaker, he says, is that the economy experienced a general slowdown in the growth momentum that has been stimulated by activities associated with World Cup cricket. Thus, from a growth rate of 4.9% in 2006, preliminary estimates indicate that real economic growth decelerated 0.5% in 2007. Minister of Finance explains the decline in growth rate by what is taking place internationally, the so-called effects of the hurricane, high prices. But I ask you to think for a moment. I ask you, Madam Speaker, to think for a moment. Surely, of these factors affected other economies in the region? Surely, the countries of St. Vincent and Dominica were affected. And this gives us an important clue. I have always known that in every budget in this country, that when we come to assessing our economy, we always look at what our partners are doing and their performance. And you know why? It is not for ordinary purposes of comparison to say that we are better off than Antigua or Dominica St. Vincent, because that is a language in these times we ought never to use, but because we share a common currency. That's the reason why. And we share common monetary policy. True, the Minister of Finance makes a confession. Says, Madam Speaker, economic growth in the Eastern Currency Union is expected to show improvement for 2007, albeit at a slower rate than in 2006. He couldn't put it otherwise, because the figures are indeed very startling. Why is it that our sister economy showed growth and our economy plummeted? Madam Speaker, these are the statistics. In 2007, the Anguilla
economy... I'm reading the opposition. You're quoting from a document?
I am quoting.
From which document are you quoting?
I am quoting from an ECCD document. Right?
Okay, would you make it a document
of the
House?
I would make it a document of the House. Anguilla, 11.87%. Antigua and Barbuda, 6.31%. Dominica, 1.63%. Grenada, 3.55%. Montserrat, 0.85%. St. Kitts and Nevis, 3.11%. And this is interesting. I will skip it over, but return. The figure they had for St. Lucia, I'll come back. St. Vincent and the Grenadines, 7.75%. The ECCU as a whole, 4.85. At the time that these statistics were prepared, the ECCB estimated a growth rate for St. Lucia for this year at 2.85%. Clearly, they were wrong, and it is now for us to speculate about the information that led them to their conclusion that there would have been a slowdown but to 2.89%. Madam Speaker, it is very hard when you're in government, especially when you have twin responsibilities, that of Prime Minister and Minister of Finance. The toughest thing for people around you to tell you that the economy is in trouble. Very hard. Never easy. It is even harder when you see your own people tell you bagay baka wed. Aye baka fed. Masa mana ye. It's tough. But the worst thing to do is to mislead them about their economic condition and their economic future. Yes, on this side of the house, we use this word crisis to describe the situation we're in, because it is a crisis, and it is a crisis not just for the government, but it is a crisis for all of us. And it is precisely because it is a crisis for all of us, then all the more reason why we have to hearken to the message of the member for NICU North and seek to redesign our approaches and the politics of our country. St. Lucia is entering a crisis like it has never had before in the last 15 years. Why do I say it's a crisis? The first obvious thing, as I indicated, is that this is an economy in recession. And Madam Speaker, when economists speak of economies in recession, what they mean very simply is that an economy experienced 2 quarters of negative growth. And if you've had an economy that has plummeted to 0.5%, then it is obvious over a year that you're in recession. And the symptoms become clear. Unemployment rises, problem with prices, wages are stagnant. But there's a deeper problem. A deeper problem that the members on this side have been attempting to articulate today. It is this looming food crisis that we must all address. And I want to be kind to the government before I delve into it. I want to be fair. It is true that when this government inherited office, the government knew about the escalating fuel prices. It is true that the government knew about high prices, but what the government may not have anticipated, because it has hit the world suddenly, is this issue of the looming crisis in food supply and food production. But there is another factor that tells us that we are in crisis like the rest of the world. It is the uncontrollable high prices, the uncontrollable high energy prices, the obvious inflationary spiral, and as I indicated, with the contraction in economic performance, lower increase in wages, and the real likelihood and possibility of stagnant wages. I repeat what I have said. In his budget presentation of the Prime Minister, he avoided as best as he could casting aspersions on the opposition. But he couldn't resist. He had to suggest that the opposition would clap its hands in glee because of the economic state of the country. But this crisis don't have to do solely with the government. It has to do with the entire country. And the collective mind and wisdom of this country must be brought together to deal with this crisis. I do not think, Madam Speaker, that the issue of the food crisis should be ignored at all. It is a matter that we need to put our collective minds to address. And if you'll permit me, Madam Speaker, I'm going to read from the Trinidad Guardian because I'll actually make it available to this House. A statement which appeared in the Trinidad Guardian on March 20th. The statement is quoting the Minister of Trade for Trinidad Tobago, Rowley, Keith Rowley, Dr. Keith Rowley. He said, at their recent conference in the Bahamas, the Director General of the United Nations UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, Jacques Hughes, alarmed heads of government of the Caribbean community, CARICOM, with the warning that the world is on the brink of a serious food shortage. Recalling the moment at a press conference on March 14 in the Ministry of Finance Tower, Eric Williams Financial Complex in the Peninsula Port of Spain, Trade and Industry Minister Dr. Keith Rowley said, quote, he gave the data, he gave the figures with respect to the significant reduction in the availability of food around the world. And he told CARICOM heads that he had come to the meeting to impress upon them this grave situation, to let them know they must do everything possible within their borders to produce whatever they can, because the prognosis is that food on the world market will become more and more in short supply and automatically become more and more expensive. Rowley said the youth also warned that in the future there would come instances where even if the money was available, the stocks would not be available for purchase. Translated, you may have the money, you may have the income, but you cannot find the food to buy. That's the reality. Rowley said the youth told conference participants that he was so concerned about the looming food crisis that he had organized a conference in Rome for heads of government from around the world to meet and discuss the global food situation. He urged CARICOM leaders to attend the meeting. It is approaching a crisis situation, Rowley said. He added that the youth even revealed that the situation had become so serious that the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, a humanitarian agency, was unable to get enough food to supply the refugees under its care and could only provide food to some of the people in the refugee program. Madam Speaker, it is against that background that the opposition is urging that this matter of the approaching food crisis be taken seriously. It is against this background we are suggesting that we must turn course now and redesign our approach to this issue. You will permit me, Madam Speaker, an additional reference, because I believe that this matter is so very important that we need to drive the problem and the nature of the problem home. I want to take a simple commodity, rice. Already the members have spoken about the problems we have with rice. Rice is now a major staple in the diet of solutions, as is the case in the rest of the Caribbean. All over the world, adjustments have been made. In the Philippines, where rice was a major staple, restaurants have cut down on the amount of rice served, and now they give you only one cup whenever you order a dinner that includes rice. But we must have a real concern about rice supply in our region. The fact of the matter is that while Guyana is a major supplier of rice to this region, the Guyanese at this time, because of the scarcity and high prices, seem preoccupied with two things. One, securing the highest returns by exporting as much rice as possible. But secondly, they have said to us, and I'm quoting directly from another statement on the issue, a statement made, Madam Speaker, in another article which is available and will be circulated. The statement comes from
the thing. What is the title of the Guardian?
The Guardian, Madam Speaker. The statement comes from Jagmeet Singh, General Manager of Guyana's Rice Development Board. It makes it quite clear that before Guyana could look after the rest of the world, Guyana must look after itself. He says, quote, "The first law of nature is self-preservation. We have had requests to export everything we have." Madam Speaker, this has to raise a challenge for us. The security of supply of rice as a staple, and secondly, combating the inevitable price increases that will follow. It is clear that this problem has to be approached in a systematic way. It is true that the budget has line items that speak of assistance to farmers. But assistance to farmers is not the way that you deal with the crisis that you are facing. It has to be designed, it has to be organized differently. The entire country has to be mobilized, every single individual to prepare and to respond to the crisis of which we speak. Like everybody else, we are afflicted with high prices. And for purposes of this presentation this afternoon, I will ignore what the members on the other side said to citizens of this country during the election campaign and what they promised in their manifesto. I will ignore all of that because it is clear that what was promised cannot materialize. It's impossible, not where prices are concerned. But what bothers the opposition, Madam Speaker, is the approach of the government to this issue. The government has decided to respond by increasing the range of items under price control. People react emotionally to price control because they believe that what it does is to prevent price gouging. And people need anything they could cling on to. Amazingly, of course, this government announced since October, November last year that it was working on this issue of high prices and price controls. Today, we are in April, and up to now, this issue cannot be finalized, allegedly because of consultation. But then what is the secret about what goods you're going to put under price control? What is really the secret about this? Why do we have to make this a secret that you're going to put goods under price control? You now have a budget. This is the time when the people of St. Lucia expect to hear the details of your budget and precisely what you want to do. Already we have a number of items under price control, and what the ministry has done is to prepare an additional list of items that is going to put under price control. Baby juices, cheese, chicken bats, chicken drumsticks, chicken legs, chicken wings, corn beef, chocolate, tea, luncheon meat, margarine, oil, edible, powdered soap, salted biscuits, tea, tin fish, toilet soap, toothpaste, chronic foods, turkey drums, turkey wings. And it appears that the plan is to have a maximum wholesale price of 10% and a maximum retail price of 15%. But the question is, will price controls work? That is the question. Will St. Lucians get relief from high prices because of price controls? Will the elderly stop crying because of price control? Let's call it fair to say. Price controls cannot stop price increases. It is as simple as that. You may introduce price controls today because you reduce on the margin of profit on your first shipment, prices may go down. That's it. If prices continue to escalate, to increase when you import, automatically the prices will go up. And that is the lesson of the items we currently have under price control. Because the items that we have under price control, prices continue to rise. Why, therefore, are we engaged purely for the sake of action in doing this, to give people the impression that we are doing something? Dealing with the issue of prices has to be more fundamental than this. It is not for me to tell the government how the business sector will react with prices, but one thing I know for sure, in this period of crisis, in this period of escalating crisis, one of the options that we have to pursue is a question of supply. Can we change our sources and look at alternative sources of supply rather than the traditional sources? Will this discourage businessmen from looking at alternative sources? These are the issues, these are the questions that we need to study. Then the government says, follow the pack, reduce the seizure. I think it's very important that as we reflect on this approach, we consider what the CEC seeks to do. As everybody knows, translated, the CEC means Common External Tax. It is the CARICOM-imposed tax to protect domestic production in the region by putting higher taxes on goods imported from outside CARICOM. It is obvious that the government has a real difficulty. Because the reality is that they can only identify five products or five items to seek a dispensation from CARICOM to reduce the CEC. Again, Madam Speaker, the relief would be short term. You remove the CEC, then you may get a slowdown in prices for a short period, and that's it. Then the cycle of price increases resumes. But I guess in these circumstances, any little thing you can do matters. But all solutions are reeling particularly from the high energy prices. Every single person is concerned. And this side has never suggested to the government that the price of fuel ought not to be increased. Never. We were there, we understood. The issue has always been how you handle it. And it is easy to understand a vital difference between this administration and the former Labour administration. We would have never ever increased the price of kerosene from $5 and a few cents to $11. Neither would we have ever equated the price of diesel with the price of gasoline, because obviously it would have had an inflationary spiral. The people who use diesel in their vehicles are contractors, farmers. These are the people who are affected by this sudden increase, by the abolition of the differential. And further, there is now no incentive for people to purchase diesel vehicles. But there is one item that has to concern all of us sitting around this table this evening. It is the issue of electricity. No consumer can negotiate over electricity prices. Every one of us have had the experience of watching those electricity bills go up and up and up and up. The explanation is the fuel surcharge. The high fuel prices. But citizens cannot negotiate with this commodity. But what is startling is this. If we are in crisis mode, why is it that the government has not held any dialogue with Lucilec and say to Lucilec, look, the country is going through a painful period. People cannot meet their commitments. It is true that the price of fuel is going to go up. Can you consider reducing your profit margins and reduce prices? Can you think of doing that? At least for a temporary period, whether it is a year or a year and a half or 2 years, to bring relief. Because whether we like it or not, there are going to be consequences even for our manufacturing sector. And the Prime Minister himself alludes to that problem. But there's another issue that we have to consider. When the Labour Party was in office, we negotiated with Lucelec a rebate of several million dollars that was made available A, to the manufacturing sector and to the most indigent in the society to help them pay the cost of the electricity bill. Question, Mr. Prime Minister, Mr. Minister of Finance, what has happened to that? Why haven't we pursued it? Why haven't we insisted that Lucelec meets its social responsibilities in these difficult times and makes that rebate available? Perhaps that has been done and we are unaware of it. But this administration must display courage. This administration has to rethink its foreign policy outlook and has to make adjustments because our people require help and assistance. The opposition has made it clear that if this government enters into appropriate agreement on Petro-Caribbean, we will support it because we know of its potential benefits. We have repeatedly said that in any event, the Venezuelan oil company owns the Hess facility in St. Croix 50-50 with Hess. And the basis exists for cooperation between Hess and Cerveza, the Venezuelan oil company. What are we afraid of? What is it that we are afraid of? That we will surrender our democracy if we establish relations in Venezuela? They said the same thing when we established relations with Cuba. Today we are alive and well, no matter what the Minister of Commerce may have said about Cuban democracy and St. Lucian and the intentions of the St. Lucian Labour Party. But our democracy is alive and well. What are we afraid of? The harsh reality is that the situation we are in requires special and extraordinary steps. We have to rethink. We have to concede some relief to the distressed among us, especially the elderly, especially the poor. You will understand, Madam Speaker, why this budget is of such critical importance at this time. I do not know whether the Prime Minister understood how important and how critical and how defining this budget should have been. The annual national budget, like this budget, represents the single most definitive and transparent opportunity available to any government to present the citizens of a country with a concise and accurate report on economic performance and the prospects for the immediate future. Obviously, the Prime Minister and the opposition disagree fundamentally on the nature of the problem facing us. And I want to go back to that just for a minute. If I have shown that OECD economy is growing, they face the identical problem. Is there the possibility that we have problems that are unique to Petrucha, unique structural problems in our economy that has led to this decline? What has they? That is the issue. A budget address, once it is properly conceptualized, articulated, and delivered, ought to achieve three objectives. Firstly, it will accurately set out the government's plans for revenue collection and expenditure on recurrent services and capital projects. In other words, a statement of accounts. This budget has attempted to do this, but there are obviously imperfections, and we'll come to that in a short while. Clearly, targets must be defined, targets must be set, there must be project sequencing. timing must be realistic, and this is going to be a big issue in this budget when the Prime Minister says that we're going to witness the start of 7 hotels in Ireland this budgetary cycle. Equally, the sources of revenue must identify both revenue and both recurring and capital. And the arithmetic must make sense. The addition and subtraction must make sense. Secondly, the budget is the government's policy tool of economic short-term strategy within the context of a larger economic plan. The strategy must reflect and be a response to active circumstances, issues, and to the time that faces the country. The reality is that what is facing this country at this time is an economic recession. Exceedingly high prices, high fuel prices, a declining agricultural sector. These are unusual times. To translate, if you're going through monetary and, let us say, employment tightness, a responsive budget will seek to ease the pressures. It will be sensitive. It will take the lead through the appropriate investments. It will take the lead to ease the problems of liquidity in the system and say, how are you going to deal with liquidity? Yes, this budget talks about investment, but how realistic? But then, of course, I accept the third leg of the philosophy. The budget must articulate the political vision of the government as expressed through its manifesto. I have always respected that because you made a contract with the public. But equally, when circumstances have changed, you must have the courage to say you were wrong and abandon the manifesto, as the former Prime Minister told you. He sat in that chair and he said, forget what we said during the election campaign. Forget the promises. That was the message. That was the message because the times have changed. What are the underlying premises of this budget? Let us analyze the premises on which this budget is based. The first is that the budget is premised on a 7% growth rate next year, item 1. The second is, without saying so, I guess they're afraid to say so, and we shall come to that in a minute. The budget seeks to stimulate economic activity by extraordinary and heavy borrowing. To be precise, $236 million. And we shall come to that in due course. And then the third premise, there will be extraordinary private sector investment in tourism. I'm not going to get trapped in the semantics or get involved in the semantics of which government puts socialists and opposition talking about over-reliance on tourism. The position of the opposition has always been clear. The predicament that we face in agriculture, yes, we must make adjustments in agriculture. We must modernize it. We must build the linkages between tourism and agriculture, but in the short term, faced with chronic problems of unemployment, we have to modernize and develop our services sector. You know, my problem is this. When I look at the proposal, I have never seen such a mishmash of proposals. You get the impression that this is an abracadabra of a budget. I have never seen such a mixture of proposals. But let's look at this issue of a 7% growth. You know, those who are involved in agriculture would know that there is something you call Miracle-Gro, I think. It's a special fertilizer. The intention is that when you apply that fertilizer, then you get abundant growth. It's a miracle. We're going to have a miracle in St. Lucia next year. We're going to have 7% growth. My problem, Mr. Minister of Finance, is this. Why did you give your blessing to this proposal and to this recommendation? Who misled you? Who led you to think that it is possible, admirable as it may be, to get a 7% growth in GDP next year? How could you get a 7% growth, Mr. Minister of Finance?
Honorable Leader of the Opposition, you address the chair at all times. Begin the
Thank you. It is a pleasure always to address you, Madam Speaker. And I do so now with great pleasure. How, Madam Speaker, would you say that a 7% economic growth would be achieved, especially given the shrinking economic base that we have just spoke about? Interestingly, Madam Speaker, over the past 18 years, the St. Lucia economy grew by 7% only once. And I want very briefly to turn to some of these records so that you can understand my reference. In 1990, the economy, I'm reading from the Social Economic Review, a document of the House, in 1990, the economy grew by 4.23%. In 1991, by 0.07%. In 1992, by 7.42%, and I'll come back to that. In 1993, by 1.05%, Madam Speaker. In 1994, by 1.83%. In 1995, by 1.69%. In 1996, by 1.37%. In 1997, by 0.57%. In 1998, provisional 2.87%. Now, when that economy grew in 1992, the circumstances were most extraordinary because I believe that it was the year of a major national disaster. And not unusual. In nearly every country where you've had major national disasters of one type or another, you may have a sudden upset. It may also have been the year when our returns from bananas were particularly high, but we shall come back to that in a few minutes. But the fact is, once in 18 years. The truth of the matter is, this is not to say that it is impossible to get a 7% growth rate. Because I just read out figures from OECD countries indicating countries like Anguilla with an 11% growth rate. Of course, you may think that St. Lucia is a modern China. People's Republic I'm talking about. I'm not talking about Taiwan. And therefore is in a position to grow by 7%. But the harsh reality is that you have a shrinking economic base. You have described the international environment as being particularly difficult. But something bothers me, Madam Speaker. Something really bothers me. None of the international agencies forecast that the St. Lucia economy would grow by 7% next year. Every single one has discounted that possibility. And more telling, Madam Speaker, and this time, for ease of reference, I am going to refer to an article in the Nation newspaper. Happy to make it a document of the House. It is not easy to get official documents, the one I have in the newspaper. And this is what the International Monetary Fund says. The International Monetary Fund, IMF, said growth in the Caribbean would slow to 4.4% this year and 3.8% next year compared to 5.7% growth in 2007. The IMF is predicting a dramatic slowdown in the economic growth of Caribbean countries over the next 2 years because of recession in the United States and turmoil in worldwide financial markets. In its latest World Economic Report released Wednesday, the IMF said growth in the Caribbean region would slow to 4.4% this year and 3.8% next year compared to 5.7% growth last year. Now, that's the IMF. That's their view.
Honourable Leader of the Opposition, you have 10 more minutes in which to complete the presentation.
Now, I've agreed.
Madam Speaker, I move that the Honourable Member be given extra half hour to complete the presentation.
Honourable Leader of the Opposition, do you have a counter motion? You're standing. I will put the question. Honourable Member of the past to be.
Madam Speaker, I wish to move that Section 3210 be voted to give the Honourable Leader of the Opposition an extra hour to complete this contribution.
We have a current motion. I will put the first motion first. Honourable members, the question is that Standing Order 3210 be invoked to allow the Leader of the Opposition an additional half hour within which to complete his presentation. I now put the question. As many as have the opinion say aye. As many as will be contrary opinion say no. I think the ayes have it.
Call for division.
The division in accordance with the standing orders will be taken in alphabetical order. Sir?
What he agreed on before. That's a problem.
Honourable members, the results of the division, 6 no's and 7 ayes. The ayes have it.
Thank you, Madam.
An additional half hour.
Thank you, Madam. The second element, as I indicated, was a massive public debt. This amount that is used to finance the capital budget follows an 8.1% increase in the public debt last year incurred by this government. And as I indicated, this budget is heavily financed by borrowing of $235 million. Now, pause for a moment. Very clearly, this amount of borrowing is unprecedented for a government that crucified the former administration on debt. This surely has to be one of the highest amounts ever borrowed in 1 year. And mind you, Madam Speaker, we have not even started to finance the construction of the tunnel. That is the reality. $235 million in debt to be incurred this year, of which $120 million is before us for approval. I do not make the point lightly that it may well be the highest amount of debt ever incurred in a single year. I am disabled because I'm unable to get all the information, but I certainly will get it in due course to determine exactly what were the borrowings on an annual basis by the former government to really answer this fundamental issue. But then the government relies heavily on private investment. This is what intrigues me. How much of this is really wishful thinking? In the first place, you have an anti-investment climate. The international financial community is in turmoil. Everybody is scared of lending. You have a problem in St. Lucia with liquidity. Demand requirements are heavier than actual cash in the bank. But Mr. Prime Minister, you're in office now for a whole year. You have been monitoring. You know full well, as I do, that it takes more than a year to get a project from conceptualization to actual commencement of construction. The robot resort in Labrie is a classic case in point. And the history of investment in St. Lucia is littered with broken promises about commencement of projects. Many of these projects involve the acquisition of land, the acquisition of licenses, preparation of design. Settlement of loan agreements. And you are saying to this country that you are able to announce the commencement of 7 projects this year. I am beginning to wonder, Mr. Minister of Finance, whether 7 is your lucky number. Because you speak of 7 projects and then you speak of a growth rate of 7% this coming year. It has to be your lucky number. I am conscious, Madam Speaker, that I have limited time. I'm conscious. This is the second time this has happened. When the former government was in office, it never denied the opposition time to speak. I make it very clear that we're not going to hear the last of this issue in this office. The denial of the right of the leader of the opposition to respond adequately to the budget of the time. I will now turn very quickly to some budgetary issues, because I have some issues of governance to speak about. We know that there's an increase in recurrent expenditure from $686,207,098 to a whopping $743,338,916. Guess what? The promise to reduce recurrent expenditure by $300 million is gone, evaporated, disappeared, vanished. And of course, you're going to be told in the reply that it's because arrangements have been made for the increases in the salaries of civil servants. Then the Prime Minister gloats about the increase in revenue intake. That makes him happy because he believes that he has a buoyant economy, and this is evidence of a buoyant economy. Take a pin. Stop for a minute. will make a statement. Perhaps I can be misunderstood, misjudged, misunderstood. When prices are high, the government will waste money. One of the reasons why the government revenues and international taxes increase is because of the high prices of goods entering the country. The higher the price of goods, the greater return of your taxes if you keep your tax rate constant. Mr. Prime Minister, the time has come to look at your entire gamut of consumption taxes and ease the people of St. Lucia from the high prices by reducing the consumption tax rate, because you are making up for it because of the high prices of the goods that you import. You need to temper consumption taxes in this environment. We have noted, Madam Speaker, the allocation of revenue in this budget. We turn to page 496. By my calculation, the ministry that gets the most money this year is the ministry of the Minister of Communications and Roads, $72 million. Second ministry is Tourism and Civil Aviation, and I want to come back to that ministry in a while. Number two, Ministry of Economic Affairs, one that I have special interest in, number three. And then, of course, the Ministry of Agriculture, Land, Forestry and Fisheries, number four. Ministry of Health, way down to number five. So this year, most of the money goes to the Ministry of Communications and Works. But there's something that are bothering me about the Ministry of Economic Affairs. That ministry always intrigues me. I want to refer to page 511. I have never seen such extraordinary vagueness, in a budget definition of project titling before. Item 205, Southern Quadrant Economic Development Program, $6.626 million. Item 208, Castries Economic Development Program. Item 212, National Development Planning Framework, $1.230 million. Why are you providing this ministry with this, with all of these consultancy fees when people are suffering? Why is the minister being given all this money for consultancy activities when the elderly in this country need help? We do not need these consultancy studies at this time. And it's deliberately vague to cover a multiplicity of sins. You have to wonder behind which of these items there's a Riley Graham lurking. And I'll come to that in a few minutes. But Mr. Prime Minister, why are you allocating $500,000 to an official residence? In this period of crisis, tell me seriously, should we be allocating $500,000 to an official residence? Mr. Prime Minister, I don't want to be personal. I will not be personal. I refuse to be personal.
The Chair of the Opposition, please do not forget to address the Chair.
Yes, Madam Speaker, I know you wish to be involved in everything, so I certainly will address you. I'm not merely asking, Madam Speaker, what is the priority at this time in this moment of great difficulty? Not often I elicit a laugh from my good friend from the Ministry of Communication, but no, yes, it's alright. But then, without making any comment, the allocation to the Ministry of Communication and Works is rather unusual and rather untidy. If we turn to page 505, Madam Speaker, I hope you'll be kind enough to let me know when I have 15 minutes left. There are three projects under this ministry, all carrying the same name with minor variations. And the Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance knows what I'm talking about, because it was raised in discussion when the Finance Committee met. Item 248, Community Infrastructure Development, $4.1 million from Lowe's. Item 259, Community and Agriculture Field Road, $12.9 million. Item 266, Rehabilitation of Community Roads, $10.596 million. In short, the Honorable Minister is provided for community roads, stroke agriculture feeder roads, some $27.6 million. I have never seen such budgetary untidiness before. What was going on? What is going on? And this is not a matter for him, for the minister. It is a matter for the technocrats within the ministry to define their projects carefully so that you don't have this kind of overlap. No one knows exactly what is happening under each item. Then there is an allocation of $2 million for riverbank stabilization. Pray, Madam Speaker, which rivers, which banks are going to be tackled? Tell us about these rivers and banks that are going to be tackled, and $2 million is going to be spent on this year. Madam Speaker, I'm forced to go quickly, and I will. I note, Madam Speaker, that Taiwan is contributing $29 million to this budget. At long last, we have seen some attempt to bring Taiwan into the regulatory framework of the Finance Act. Question is whether they will be totally brought in or they're going to be brought in partially. Obviously, Madam Speaker, this $29 million is a far cry from what was promised by the People's Republic of China, $104 million. And that is why the capital program is in your budget. Unless you're now telling me what you put in your budget is a promise. Come on. The fact of the matter is that it is precisely because that $104 million was not available while the capital program of this government faltered and wide collapsed. That's the reason why. That is the reason why. Why there was no serious capital investment last year. But, Mr. Prime Minister, this is the time to clarify the policy position on Taiwan. Whether Taiwan will continue to make funds available outside of the framework of the Finance Act. Whether Taiwan will accede to following the financial rules and advertise all projects which it finances and which now falls in this budgetary cycle. You may wonder why I have concerns, why we have concerns. Those concerns have been articulated time and time again, but it's a more fundamental reason. Since last financial year, the Minister of Agriculture announced that, quote-unquote, an abattoir, now a meat processing facility, would be constructed down in the south in Beaufort. It's a long history. I'm not going to waste my time and go to that history. This budget makes provision of $7.9 million from the Taiwanese. It's inside this budget. Minister of Finance, I invite your clarification. My information is that the Minister of Agriculture has indicated very clearly that contracts for this particular project should be awarded to people in the South, and I'm asking a question. And I'm inviting the Minister of Finance to reply when he has an opportunity to do so. But more than that, this same project that is now listed here, four individuals were invited to bid for the construction of this meat processing facility. Why? When this item has been brought into the financial system of the country, the procurement rules of the government should apply. Why is it that the four contractors were specifically invited to bid on this project, without this project being advertised to all and sundry, so that they too may bid on this project. Why? I will not mention names today. I will defer mentioning names today. But I wait your response, and I'm merely asking a question. I made the point earlier that we need to give a helping hand to the indigent, the poor, to the elderly, because truly these are difficult times. I said that this crisis affects all of us. It affects us as a nation, as a people, but it also affects us as a politician. No one who is sitting in this room can tell me that in the last few months they have not seen a sudden increase in the number of persons coming to them for help, particularly elderly persons. My good friend, the member from Denry South, has a difficulty when the Labour Party says the government doesn't have a heart, it doesn't have a soul, it doesn't have a social conscience. He hates to hear that language. Yes, the Prime Minister talks about his Puente project. But the Puente project is not going to buy food on the table. It is not going to pay electricity bills. It is not going to buy medicines. And I seriously want to suggest to the Prime Minister that not only he cuts back on the amount of money allocated for the fanciful dreams of the Minister of Economic Planning, he makes some of that money available to the poor of St. Lucia. Prime Minister, Madam Speaker, only last year we were told that there would be one tunnel. This budget, now there are three tunnels to construct. We have moved from one, even a tunnel on the Bocage. But there is an approach you might wish to consider, Mr. Prime Minister. Your good friend in Grenada, Prime Minister Keith Mitchell, the administration of Prime Minister Keith Mitchell, and you know how far you go back. You know who he says in the polls, and we are watching with keen interest to see what happens. But when he faced those difficulties in Grenada with rising prices, he approached the petroleum fund in Trinidad and Tobago, obtained, I believe, $6 or $7 million, and converted that into direct support for the poor by way, I believe, of food vouchers and an equivalent thereto. I urge you to access this fund. I urge you to consider this approach to give a helping hand to those who are in distress, but temporarily. Because as a country, we cannot encourage mendicancy throughout the length and breadth, but people do need a helping hand. You have limited options in dealing with fuel, limited options in dealing with rising prices, very limited. Alternatives have to be considered.
Honourable Leader of the Opposition, you have 15 minutes left.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. No. I don't want it, but I will not be double changed. I want now, in conclusion, given my limited time, to turn to issues of governance. The Prime Minister was very, very, very eloquent. And listen to him, Madam Speaker, at page 58. Lovely words. In this regard, Madam Speaker, greater accountability will be required from accounting officers in the public service. Managers, Madam Speaker, will have to fulfill their responsibility for the efficient management of human and financial resources entrusted to them. Managers will have to make a greater effort to ensure compliance with the financial and procurement regulations and policies of government. And Madam Speaker, managers will have to monitor their own operations and take corrective action to ensure that the objectives of the department are achieved. Nice words. Pretty, pretty, pretty words. Especially coming after the word that you have now made so popular, maladministration. Maladministration. Very pretty words. I said it to you. It is usual for politicians to ask for this of others. We always demand from others and tell them how they should behave. But you know, we never put these demands on ourselves. We ask those things of others, but not of us. And it is one of the conundrums of political office that is fascinating. But while you ask the public officers this, I want to remind the public officers of this country that their first duty is not to the political party in office, but to the constitution of the land. The best way to protect the people of St. Lucia from rapacious politicians is to uphold the constitution, observe it, respect its four corners, treat it as a sacred document. Because that, in the final analysis, is your defense. Having said that, I now want to turn to some issues of concern to me, and very quickly. I made a point on them last year that one of the problems of this administration is that it tries to recreate the past. It's a mindset, and I tried and pleaded and urged that, look, break that cycle. One of the first things that this administration did was to merge the posts of PS and Director of Finance. I invite you to ask the Attorney General whether this arrangement is constitutional and within the four corners of the Constitution. It is my view that it is patently wrong. The Constitution of St. Lucia in Section 69, I believe, makes it very, very clear that a department of government is to be under the control of a permanent secretary. It says, where any minister has been charged with responsibility for any department of government, he shall exercise general direction and control over that department. And subject to such direction and control, every department of government shall be under the supervision of a public officer whose office is referred to in this constitution as the office of permanent secretary. When you merge the post of permanent secretary and director of finance, it means the director of finance is accountable to the same and one person. Who are you going to appeal to? Who is the director of finance going to appeal to? To himself? Check the Finance Administration Act. What it does is to lay out a regime of responsibilities for the director of finance. But maybe he's untouchable. Maybe. Maybe. But then you have a minister who is on the loose. You have a minister who is on the loose. Mr. Prime Minister, I'm referring to your Minister of Tourism. Let me ask you something. Let me ask cabinet members. Is he a law unto himself? Does he make any law in this country and break any law? Is he not answerable to the laws of this country? I want to refer you to Statutory Instrument 2008 number 49, circulated with your papers. These are the incentives to the hotel in Lavery. Are there difficulty with incentives being given to Roebuck International? Everybody here knows that this project started on the Labour Party. We have supported it, we have applauded it. But the minister claims to act under Section 3 and 8 of the Tourism Incentives Act, Cap 1530, and I'm going to just quote the two sections. He says, Section 3 says, a person wishing to own or operate a tourism product may apply to the minister to have the tourism project necessary to develop such product approved for the purpose of this act. For the purpose of this act, a tourism project includes balance sheet for the construction of a new hotel and of the alteration or renovation of an existing hotel, the conversion of an existing building, the furnishing equipment of a building, and on and on and on. What does this Mr. Minister do? This minister issues a statutory instrument. And he gives the hotel, firstly, 15 years tax-free. As if that is not enough, because after it's not allowing to, he gives it an additional period of 5 years. But worse, if you check section 5, and I really don't know whether this Attorney General is sleeping, something has to be wrong. Check section 5. The minister actually arrogates unto himself the power to waive the environmental levy and service charge. Where does the Minister of Tourism get the power to waive the environmental levy and service charge? If you want to waive the service charge, you have to declare the entity exempt for purposes of the service charge. But he goes further. Mr. Prime Minister, why are you allowing your ministers to engage in these acts, to treat as, to behave as if their powers are themselves? Look at section 6. He says, the declared benefit with regard to property tax is a 100% relief from property tax to the development company and the purchases of the condominium unit for a term of 20 years. Where does he get the power to waive property tax? Obviously, he has to be a law unto himself. Totally uncontrollable. It is for that reason that I warned public officers that they have a responsibility to make sure that the laws of this country are followed and put an end to the recklessness that exists. Since when does a Minister of Tourism have the power to declare exempt from property tax the developer? Where does that power come from? But you know, Minister, Mr. Minister of Finance, again you spoke eloquently, you returned to an old problem. Good for you. Abuse of government, good for you. It's one that all administrations have been grappling with, good for you. But let me tell you this though. There's an iron law in government. Politicians, we break the iron law from time to time. Sometimes unknowingly, sometimes knowingly, but we take the risk. The iron law is this, that ministers of government must always be an example to the employees of the government, but also to the nation at large. There you go talking out of abuse and waste. But you know, Mr. Minister of Finance, the evidence that I have before me suggests that since this administration has elected to office, you have purchased about 40 new vehicles.
Honorable Leader of the Opposition, I have admonished you on a number of occasions about not speaking to the chair.
I apologize once again, Madam.
And if you will try.
I will try hard now, because in my closing moment. The numbers, I can tell you some of the vehicles purchased from which agencies, Madam Speaker. I do apologize on this year. Madam Speaker, Bishkoma 18, Northwest 6, Peter & Company 6, and the rest, Suzuki, Hyundai, Land Rover, other car dealers, including BMW. Now forget, I'm not including BMWs and Fortuna and this and that and, we're leaving that out. That's for another show, as somebody could say. But it seems that this Minister of Finance has special affection for particular ministers. I'll give an example. In 2007, the former Prime Minister, Sir John Comden, approved the purchase of a vehicle from Northwest for $90,220 for the use of the Ministry of Economic Affairs. The vehicle was then purchased, an SUV Everest. The vehicle was smashed by somebody in Economic Affairs. Nobody knows the circumstances under which it was damaged. It's not that my good friend from the constituency of Anthony can read that the circumstances were well known, and I invite him to investigate this one. The vehicle was brought to Northwest, Madam Speaker. Northwest ordered some parts for it. While the parts were in order, the present Minister of Finance approved purchase of another SUV Everest for Economic Affairs for the sum of $90,000. And some ministers around your table begin to wonder why they are treated the way they are. What is,
Madam Speaker, on a point of order? I believe the Leader of the Opposition should present the evidence.
I take the challenge, Madam Speaker. I take the challenge and I will present the evidence at the appropriate time. before this debate is over. Ah, I will present the evidence. Thank you for going that route. The final point, Madam Speaker, I'm told. I accept, and my constituents that you fought, I ask you to understand, I have been denied my right to speak, I have been denied my right to represent you, so I cannot address you and address your issues. But I want you to understand because you have suffered under the UWP before. That's nothing new to you. And you will manage yourself as you have always done with dignity and honor. That is our people in default thought, bold and brave and courageous. But, Madam Speaker, I want to ask the Minister of Finance a question. This is the forum where we have to clear issues, to clear any potential for embarrassment to the government and to the country. There are suggestions, Madam Speaker, and I repeat, I'm only asking for answers. I am only asking for clarification. The Prime Minister does not invite me to sit and speak with him to raise issues, so I have to take another route to raise these issues. I am told, and if you notice, Madam Speaker, we are told of companies investing in this country, but we are never told of the individuals behind those companies. Nobody knows whether there is a Riley Graham looking behind these companies because we are not told of their identities. But I am told, Mr. Prime Minister, and I invite you to clarify for me, please, whether there is a grain of truth in it. That three businessmen from Dubai who are supposed to be investing in the ports, whatever the case is, have been granted sanctioned passports. Is there any truth to that? Because I don't understand. Mr. Prime Minister, I don't understand. Maybe you don't know and you need to investigate. I don't understand because when I check the Citizenship Act of this country, it clearly says that you should, to qualify for naturalization, you have to spend time in detention in the aggregate of about 7 years. How then, and again, I am not saying so, I beg for forgiveness because I'm not saying so. I'm asking to clarify this issue. It's important, Mr. Prime Minister, that you clarify it because you are Minister of Home Affairs. Madam Speaker, he's the Minister of Home Affairs and he is the one who signs on to the grant of citizenship. Was he misled? Was he duped? I don't know. Madam Speaker, all I am asking is a question. I just want a clarification. If the Minister of Finance, the Minister of Home Affairs tells me that this is a lie, there's no truth to it, I rest my case. Madam Speaker, I thank you for having me.